book of Revelations, it's interesting, starts off with this verse. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. Now, there's several interesting things in that. First of all, it calls it the revelation of Jesus Christ. The word revelation comes from apocalyptus, which is interpreted a number of different ways, but it comes from this derived from another Greek word called apokalypto, which means like to take the cover off of something, to unveil it. So a handful of translators have come up with the idea that it really should be translated as the unveiling. And from my study of the word, that is actually the closest translation into the English of the Greek apokalyptos, means the unveiling. So what we're told here in the very first verse, the unveiling of Jesus Christ to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. Must shortly come to pass. When was this written?
2,000 years ago.
That'd be like me saying, okay, you guys, I'm going to write this prophecy about things that will shortly come to pass, and here it is 2007, and now we're clear up to the year 4000, and nothing's happened yet. Do you think the people in the year 4000 are going to think shortly come to pass is an accurate description of what's going on?
Well, if you look at the time cycles, and that each age is 2,160 years, and that you go through each cycle of each age within each sign, shortly doesn't necessarily mean tomorrow or 100 years or 200 years. Shortly after a while is about 2,160 years.
Jerome, I'm disappointed in you to hear a fundamentalist interpretation out of your mouth. Because she's about as far away from a fundamentalist as there is. But if you say this to a fundamentalist Christian, they will say something. Well, a day with God is like 1,000 years, so that's only like a couple of days. That's kind of short, you know. But right, that's if by the normal way of looking at this, if this is a prophecy of events and it's inspired, well, we got to come up with something to explain what it is by this will shortly come to pass. And also at the end of the book, Jesus is speaking and he says, behold, I come quickly. I'm going to come quickly on this white horse that's going to come down out of the sky. I come quickly. Well, it's 2,000 years, I guess, of a day to God is 1,000 years or an age. The universe is billions of years old, you know, a couple thousand years isn't that much, you know. But by normal standards, 2,000 years isn't really quick by normal standards. Suppose some prophet says, well, you know, California is going to sink into the sea. Somebody said that in 1978, and a lot of people moved to Idaho from California around that time. Remember the song says, tie up your boat in Idaho was one of the things of that song. It was a popular song because a psychic had made a prediction that California was going to sink in the sea and the shoreline was going to be up here in Idaho. Well, we waited about 5 years. After about 5 years passed, California didn't sink. So they said it's been too long now, so it must have been a false prophecy. And that only took like about, I don't know, 3 to 5 years before everybody forgot about the prediction. But could you imagine California sinking into the sea in the year 4000? They say, oh, shortly came to pass. Didn't take too long, only took 2,000 years. Now, so is it possible there's a different meaning for shortly here? What does it mean? Why did he say shortly? These things will shortly come to pass.
Maybe it means surely. That's what I was going to say.
Now, first of all, what are some of the things that's supposed to happen in here? First, well, we're told, you know, there's going to be a great mountain, a fiery mountain, descend from the skies, land in the oceans, and kill one-third of the life in the oceans. Has that happened yet? And the name, a fiery star, that's it, and its name is Wormwood, and it will land in the oceans and kill one-third of the life. No, I haven't seen that happen yet. It's going to be an army of 200 million men descend on Jerusalem and have battle Armageddon there. Has that happened yet? No, that hasn't happened. Let me see. Two witnesses are supposed to go prophesy in Jerusalem. The beast, a beastly character, is going to rise up like Hitler, and he's going to come against them and kill them. Their dead bodies are going to lie in the streets for 3.5 days, and after 3.5 days, they're going to rise up on their feet. There's going to be a great earthquake, and everybody's going to be terrified. And every people in the whole world, it says, every people, nation, kindred, and tongue shall see these two witnesses rise up, and great fear will fall upon them which beheld them. Has that happened? No. Well, it would make the news, wouldn't it? If two guys got killed, they lied in the streets for 3 days, everybody was happy and sent gifts to each other because their dead bodies were lying in the streets. It says because these two witnesses plagued the people of the earth and irritated them. So they're so happy to see them dead. And when Christians read this, they think, well, that must mean it's got to be predicting our time. Because it says all the people of the nations were able to see their dead bodies lying on the streets. And that couldn't happen in the days of John. But with television and the internet, if a couple prophets were killed in Jerusalem, we could see their dead bodies laying in the streets today. All the nations could see it, couldn't they? But then that presents a little bit of a problem. We have this clear prophecy. So if some Hitler-type dictator killed two prophets, and they were lying in the streets, and everybody was celebrating and sending gifts to each other, that these guys were finally out of the way and dead, and they didn't even suffer their dead bodies to be buried, it said, because they were televising them for all the world to see, and all the world was rejoicing that they were dead. Wouldn't somebody think, hey, boy, this sounds like it could be the witnesses in Revelation. That means they're going to rise up on their feet after 3.5 days. So people start waiting, they rise up on their feet. Boy, that would convert everybody, wouldn't it? You would think. And how about the beast? It's supposed to be a terrible beast, and Antichrist rise up, and he's going to like put a computer chip in everybody's hand, right? Some type of mark, in everybody's right hand or their forehead. And they're going to have to do exactly what this dictator does. This dictator is going to be so bad, he's going to make Hitler look like Cinderella or Bo Peep or something like that. I mean, this guy is going to be a real SOB. And boy, he's going to control the whole world. And we're all going to get his mark. We all got to do what he says. And he's even going to be so bad, he's going to challenge Jesus. He's going to see Jesus come down on that white horse. And he's actually going to challenge him. Hey, Jesus, I'm going to fight with you. But he's not going to really put up much of a fight because Jesus is going to zap him and he's going to evaporate and all armies are going to evaporate with him and he's going to call the fowls of the air to come down and eat the flesh of all the captains and the horses. Matter of fact, they're all going to be on horses, it says. 200 million men on horses. That's kind of weird, isn't it? Well, maybe he was talking about tanks and stuff, but John just called them horses, you know. But all this is supposed to shortly come to pass. How do we explain that word shortly getting in there? Didn't mean to give you a bad time, Cheryl. But the Christian world looks at this and they have, you know, they say they think that shortly can't interfere with our interpretation. So there's lots of ways to interpret shortly. In other words, well, when these events start to happen, it's all going to happen in a short time. That's one way to look at it. Or day with God is like 1,000 years, you know. What's a couple thousand years? That's short in God's mind, you know. And Jesus says, I come quickly. Well, that could be when he comes, he's just going to come really fast, you know. So there are ways around this, but let's look at it just the way it reads. These things will shortly come to pass. Actually, it means just exactly what it says. What things? To who? Who's he talking to? Who is the book of Revelations written to? I read it to you. I bet nobody remembers. I bet nobody in this room remembers who it was written to. Yeah.
Disciples. It was written to the church.
Hey, you did good, Joshua. Great. It was written to the servants of God. Okay. And who will it come shortly to pass for?
To the servants of God.
Huh?
To the servants of God.
Everything in here is going to come shortly to pass to the disciples. Not to everybody else, but to the disciples.
Didn't John write it?
Yeah. Well, John wrote it down, but these were the words John was given. And then it says this thing here. It says, "Blessed is he that readeth, and they that heareth the words of this prophecy, and keepeth those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand." What time? What time is at hand? The time for everything in this book to come to pass shortly. In other words, and the time is at hand for who? The disciples who read, who understand, and keep. In other words, keep within their heart and their minds the words of this prophecy. And they will be blessed. Well, that's really weird, because when you read it in the normal sense, there's no blessing in the book. I mean, mountain coming out of heaven and killing all the fish, fires coming down, hailstorms, all kinds of destruction. In one plague, a third of the men of the entire earth was killed with a great army, and the beast rising up. I mean, where's the stuff that blesses everybody? Where is it at? There's nothing in there to bless anybody. Nothing in there. All it is it scares the bejesus out of you as you read the whole thing, if you believe it. I mean, you read the whole thing, well, wow, this is probably going to happen soon, because it's been 2,000 years, and soon, well, it must be going to happen pretty fast, because it can't go on much longer before soon isn't soon anymore.
I'm in the latter days.
Right, we're in the latter days and everything. So people read this, and you can just about pick anything. Let's just pick something at random. "All they that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, the beast, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. This beast exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and them which dwell in to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed, and he doth great wonders." And then it says, "He causes all rich and poor to receive his mark in the right hand of the forehead, and if they don't receive it, they'll be killed." Okay, is that anything to be happy about? No, let's just pick something else at random here. In the vision part, let's just pick something. "Behold, the sixth seal was open, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth, even as a fig tree casts her untimely figs when she is shaken out by a mighty wind. And heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and every island were moved out of their place. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman and free men hid themselves in the dens and the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, Fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For great is the day of his wrath, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand?" Read that, well, would I be able to stand? You know? "And every mountain and island out of their place, a great earthquake, the stars will shake and move, the moon will turn to blood, the earth, sun will not give its light." What is there to look forward to here? How can I be blessed by reading this book? How is it possible? And let me tell you how it's possible. Is it not about what everybody thinks it's about? The book is not about predicting the future. The book has nothing to do with predicting the future of the planet. There's several correspondences in there that predict certain cycles and events that kind of repeat themselves from time to time. But outside of that, that's not the main purpose of the book. The main purpose of the book is what is given in the first verse. It's the unveiling of Jesus Christ to show his disciples things which must shortly come to pass. "And blessed is he that readeth and keepeth the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein," within their hearts, of course. So who was he talking to? He was talking to disciples who read and study this, and the things that will shortly come to pass is the unveiling of Jesus Christ, which will shortly come to pass in the life of the disciples. That's what the whole book is about. The unveiling of Jesus Christ in the life of the disciple that reads this and keeps these things in his heart. So why didn't John just speak clearly about this? Why didn't he say that all this is symbolism about the path that the disciple leads that unveils the life of Jesus Christ within him? Why didn't he just say that?
He knew they'd destroy it.
Blasphemy.
Right, because the church would destroy it, because even the early church, a lot of people had a hard time accepting the statement of Jesus when he told the Jews, ye are gods. That's what he told them. Ye are gods. He says, you criticize me because people say that I am a son of God. And it says a son of God, not thee. But what's the big deal about that when your own scriptures says ye are gods? That's a lot bigger deal, isn't it? To say ye are gods and for anyone to say that I'm a son of God? That's a lot bigger deal to say ye are gods. So what's the big deal if I say I'm one of the sons of God? And what did they do to him after he said that to them? They picked up stones to throw at him, and he had to get out of there. They made him so mad, they immediately picked up stones to throw at him. So, what the book is really about is the unveiling, the unfolding of Jesus Christ in the life of the disciple. In other words, it starts out telling the person the unfolding of the Christ consciousness as he goes through the first initiation and unfolds the life of Christ within his heart, undergoes the second initiation and the third, where he undergoes the principle of baptism and then initiation and the third initiation, and then on until he becomes like the Christ himself. And then it goes into what he can do after he becomes like the Christ. So it really talks about three stages. The first stage is the letter to the churches, and the letters to the churches unfolds a disciple as to the steps he takes to become an initiate, a higher initiate. And these are seven stages of progression, represented by the seven churches. And the second part is where the heavens are open, and the heavens signify higher consciousness. He has a higher consciousness opens and undergoes the third initiation, where he begins to have the heavens open to him, and he's able to see what he's never been able to see before. And then it unfolds how he treads the path to become like his master, the Christ. And then the third part tells about the work of a Messiah, of a Christed one. What type of work he will do and the things that will happen as he proceeds on his work. And it ends with the consummation of the building of the New Jerusalem. So why did John write it this way? Why did he write like the end of the world? Because he knew that the people that were going to be putting together the scriptures loved the end of the world stuff. Do people still love the end of the world stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, every year there's a new prophecy. Well, the world's going to end now because we got seven planets going to be in alignment, and that's going to make the end of the world. That happened in 95 or something like that. Well, the world's going to happen the year 2000 because that's a 7,000 years prophesied in scripture. Day with God is like a, or the 6,000 years ended, and we're going to have the day of rest, the millennium. So Y2K is going to be it. That's going to be the end of the world. And a lot of people thought that that was going to be the end of the world. And then it came and gone, and nothing happened. Now the next, right after that, a lot surfaced about Planet X is going to hit us anytime. Matter of fact, several people wrote me personal letters saying, well, how come you aren't preaching about Planet X? Aren't you worried about Planet X? I says, well, no Planet X is going to show up. And highly offended over that I said that. I don't know. Now no Planet X has showed up on time. I think it's supposed to show up in 2004. 2005 still wasn't here. Matter of fact, they said Planet X was supposed to be a white dwarf. A red dwarf. And it was supposed to be here like, I remember everybody was saying back at that time when it was big, it was supposed to be here within 6 months and it was going to destroy most of the Earth. Well, I did a little figuring how big a red dwarf would have to be. It had to be bigger than the planet Jupiter. And it would have to be within the solar system. I says, you know, it would have to be big enough. It would show up as bright as the planet Venus if we were to look in the sky right now. That's how bright it would have to be right now. I says, I don't see any new orb up there as bright as the planet Venus, so it cannot physically get here in time to fulfill the prophecy that everybody's making. I mean, it's just pure science. And sure enough, it didn't. Not only didn't get here, but hasn't shown up at all. And so I've been a pretty accurate prophet on the internet, because every prophet that makes a prediction, I say it's not going to happen. And it doesn't happen, and so I guess I'm the one that's the true prophet. But the thing is, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's really easy to do. And just now, once in a while, every day, the stop clock is right twice. So one of these times, when somebody's going to make a prediction, it's going to come true. And hopefully I can catch that one so I don't look like a fool. I say, well, no, that's not going to happen, and then it might happen. But, you know, some things, like there's ongoing prediction about the economic collapse since I can remember. I mean, it's always floating out there, somebody making one. But someday there probably will be a collapse. You know, so someday somebody's going to be right, and it'll probably be not because they're psychic, but by accident, that somebody's just going to be right. There probably will be another, periodically there are significant collapses, but let's hope there's not a complete collapse. The most recent prophecy is 2012, first the end of the Mayan calendar, and a lot of people were predicting the end of the world then. But people are getting wiser. I noticed when people first started talking about it, it was a lot of the end of the world talk. And now the opinion is shifting. They're seeing all these other predictions and the end of the world haven't happened. So a lot of people are changing the prediction around 2012 to say, well, it just means the end of a cycle or the end of something else. It won't be the end of the world. Because I think people are wising up to the fact that there have been so many end-of-the-world predictions out there that people are starting to be a little bit more cautious about predicting the end of the world. End of the world won't come for millions of years, actually, so when you really think about it. But we could have a lot of problems in between. We got, you know, the threat of a nuclear war and all kinds of things that could create tremendous problems, but it's very unlikely it would be the end of mankind. So just like today, everybody is interested in the end of the world. That's the way it was in the days of John. Everybody was interested in the end of the world. The Essenes wrote a lot about the end of the world. They were expecting it, and they hid out in caves thinking that the end of the world would come, and then the Roman Empire would be destroyed, and then come out of their caves and kind of create a new civilization. But that never happened. Took the Roman Empire some time before it fell. It's hundreds of years after that. But so John wrote about the end of the world, and when they put together the Bible, they looked at it, and they were attracted by that feature of the end of the world, but a lot of them were wondering about it because it was so esoteric. A lot of them thought, well, this is too complicated, it's a little too scary. And there was a big debate whether or not to put the book of Revelations in the Bible. And it just about didn't get in. But it did. It barely squeaked in. We're lucky we have it. They had a big debate about it, and they finally got it in. Got it in by the skin of his teeth. I don't remember for sure the first time I took a look at the book of Revelations. I think it was when I was a teenager. But I know when I went on a mission for the Mormon Church, I started studying the scriptures more intently, and I realized that the book of Revelations is the most profound book in the entire Bible. There's two books that are very profound, the book of Revelations and Isaiah, and even D.K. says that these are the two most inspired books of the Bible. I've always realized that is correct. And out of the two, I think the book of Revelations is the most closest to the heart of God, so to speak. Isaiah. Yeah. Come, let us reason together, remember. Lyndon Johnson used to quote Isaiah on that all the time. So I concluded to myself, you know, I'm going to give an intense study of this book. So I got a commentary on it. It wasn't any good Mormon commentaries, because Mormons actually discourage you from studying this, because here's a phraseology in the church. They frown on you studying the mysteries, the general authorities do, because you might get some warped ideas. You know, if God wants you to understand the mysteries, he's going to speak through the prophet and he'll tell you what to think about it. Well, that didn't really keep me happy. And there's no Mormon commentaries on the book of Revelation, so I went and bought a non-Mormon commentary on the book of Revelation and found that very fascinating. Give me a little bit of additional light, but wasn't enough to unravel it. I thought, well, to really unravel the book, I have to study the book more closely. So I made a determination that I was going to memorize the entire book. I figured the most important part started with chapter 4. This is where the vision began. So I created a memorization system, and I memorized chapter 4 to chapter 22. But I memorized the whole thing over a period of next couple of years. I concentrated on my mission for about the additional 6 months I had left, and then I continued studying it after I got home. And I had it down pretty good where I could rattle off whole chapters of the book, but still I didn't understand it. I read commentary, I memorized the whole thing, and got some little light on it, you know, but still I did not understand the book. Now, what the world does it mean? What some of the things mean? Every once in a while, a phrase or two I would come up with an interesting interpretation on, but it was looking at it from the viewpoint of things happening in physical reality on the earth rather than the inner life of the disciple. But then, when it dawned on me that this occurred, that this was teaching about the inner life of the disciple, the whole vision of the book opened up, and then it became fairly easy to interpret. I won't say easy, because as I wrote the interpretation of it, it probably took more mental energy than anything I've ever written to put it all together. But it was easy compared to trying to interpret it from the regular angle that the Christian church does. So I found it very fascinating, but I found everything began to make sense for the first time. Because nothing really in the book as a whole, has never made sense. But it makes sense when we realize it's not talking about physical reality on the outside, but it's talking about the inside. What happens to the disciple when he decides that he wants to be like his master, the Christ? What he has to do to become like Christ is, and then beyond. What does he have to do? The first stages is given in the seven letters. The seven letters tell seven steps. It's also governed by seven rays. He works with the different ray energies in these seven steps. And the first one is Ephesus. Let's read that. Under the church of Ephesus write, these things saith he that holdeth the seven stars in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. I know thy works and thy labor and thy patience, and how thou canst not bear them which are evil, but hast tried them which say they are apostles, and hast found them liars. And hast borne, and hast patience, and for my name's sake hast labored and hast not fainted. Nevertheless, I have somewhat against thee, because thou hast left thy first love. Remember, therefore, from whence thou art fallen, and repent, and do the first works, or else I will come unto thee quickly, and will remove thy candlestick out of its place, except thou repent. And so on. Now, these are instructions to the disciple as he begins the path. He has the birth of the Christ in his heart, and he decides to follow on what we call the path. The path, it begins with the birth of Christ in his heart and ends with him being a master. And that is the path. Well, it doesn't really end there. It continues, but that's the major end that we're looking for as regular mortal humans here. We want to become masters, and we want to get upon the path. The word Ephesus means permission. We'll just go over this one because we don't have time to go over everything. But we'll go over the one letter to one of the churches, the first of the seven stages of progression. The word Ephesus means permission. The disciple, the first thing the disciple must do in order to tread the path is give himself permission to take that first step. Why does he have to give himself permission? Because everybody is saying to him what?
You can't
do that.
Who do you think you are?
It's like when I started studying the book of Revelations, they said to me, well, you can't study those mysteries. You're not supposed to know these mysteries. You're not, if the prophet wants you to know that, he's going to tell you. Okay? So I give myself the Ephesus step. I give myself permission to defy that. I defied that authority, and I took that step anyway. This is just one of the things. Everything the disciple tries to do when he's around in an organization controlled by the beast, and we'll get into that. Most of you know what that is. Is they will tell him, no, you cannot do that. You can't speak that way. You can't talk about this. You can't study this. You cannot go there. And so the first step the disciple needs to learn is not listen to these voices. Give himself permission to follow the inner inclinations that he has. He may not have full soul contact at this point. He's just dabbling in contacting the inner voice. He's not really sure of himself. But in order to go anywhere, even though he's not 100% sure of himself, he doesn't have 100% soul contact, he still got himself to give himself permission to take the first step. He got to give himself permission. Nobody else is going to give him permission. You ever notice that people want permission for everything they do? I like a story Curtis told me one time. He was talking to this Mormon guy, trying to convince him of the error of his ways. And he was explaining to him something he got out of the scriptures. And he says, well, what do you think of this? And he says, well, let me go talk to my bishop to find out what I think about it. Yeah, I'll go talk to my bishop, find out what I think. In other words, the guy wouldn't give himself permission to even think for himself on that small of an angle. He couldn't look at the sentence Curtis was showing him and say to himself, I'll just look at this and see what it says. No, he couldn't give himself permission to even go that far. He had to go to his bishop to find out what he thinks. My bishop will tell me what to think, and that'll be what I think on it. That's just really simple. It's also very lazy, because if you don't have to think, and everybody else does your thinking for you, then it doesn't require any effort. So it's the normal religion is the lazy man's religion. Normal thinking is the lazy man's thinking. Everybody wants permission because they don't want to figure out themselves what they're going to give themselves permission to do, because that takes a little bit of thought. And so Ephesus is permission. He has to give himself permission to explore. Maybe to explore unknown territory, to read books that everybody tells him he shouldn't be reading, to go to meetings that everybody says you shouldn't be going to associate with people that everybody says, no, you shouldn't be associating with that scum or that crowd or those weirdos over there. No, you shouldn't be going to that keys gathering. That's too weird for you. Or whatever. But the disciple has to learn to give himself permission. So the disciple has given himself permission to enter the path. And the voice, inner voice, the voice of God says to him, I know your works and your labor and your patience, how you cannot bear them which are evil. And you have tried them which say they are apostles, and you have found them liars. Who are the apostles? The apostle means a sent one. In other words, somebody that claims to be sent from God to teach you is an apostle, according in this context. So who are the apostles that he's supposed to test? These would be any minister, priest, prophets, teachers. And the inner voice is telling him, hey, you've done two things right. You're Ephesus, you've given yourself permission, and you've done something else I really like. You've tested those that claim to be apostles, representing the voice of God, and you have found them to be liars. They have lied to you. You've realized that. That's great. This is a first step you're taking on the road to becoming like your master, and you have done this part right. You've tested them, and you found out they have not been telling you the truth. Congratulations. You got a little pat on the back there from the voice of God within. And thou hast borne and hast patience, and for my name's sake has labored and has not fainted. So after he found out these things, he gave himself permission. He's exploring. He's found out certain truths, truths that conflicted with everything that he's been told. He's found out that everything everybody's been telling him hasn't been true, and he's finding out new truths. And he's congratulated also praised for not fainting, that he's continuing. Even though he's probably got a lot of flack, he's had patience and he's prodded forward. Nevertheless, he says, I have somewhat against thee because thou hast left thy first love. Now this is interesting. Remember therefore from whence thou art fallen. So the praise ends there, and he says, you know, you've done a couple things that are really good, but you're really screwing up on this one area. Now this is what happens. The disciple begins along the path. He does some things right and some things he really screws up on. And that's going to continue to happen to all of us as we go into new territory. We're never going to be perfect. He says, this is where you really screwed up. You left your first love. Remember from whence you have fallen, or else I will come unto thee quickly and will remove thy candlestick out of its place. Okay, going to remove his candlestick out of his place. That means his place, see, is his candlestick in its place right now signifies he's at the first step. He's taken the first step. He's given permission. And he says, if you don't take this advice, this first step you're on, it's going to be like you never took it. You're going to go back and be under somebody else's permission again. So you need to listen to what I'm saying. If you're going to continue on the path, you have to remember your first love. Now, the regular interpretation of the first love, they say, well, this must mean the Church of Ephesus. Their first love was the gospel, and they kind of deviated from the gospel, and so they needed to go back to the first love and start living the teachings of Christ again. You know, that's the normal interpretation almost everybody gives of this. But his first love, what was his first love as far as attempting to tread the path before he actually found the path? His first love, he was under the authority of a system, a religious system. He had teachers in it, and they told him what to do. And he listened to them, and he diligently obeyed and did everything he could to live the righteous life. He didn't deviate, but he focused, and he lived the righteous life. Like before, most of us, some of us were in the churches before we entered the path, and we were good members. Some of you were good members of a church and did what you were told, and you obeyed the Sabbath, you didn't beat your wife, you didn't steal, you didn't murder anybody, you know, you did the basic stuff. Okay? This was his first love. His first love was when he was in an organization that falsely led him to believe he was on the path. He was very diligent in fulfilling everything he was supposed to do. But he left his first love. What happens to the disciple when he gives himself permission? Hey, I can do what I want to do. He enters the path. He goes from one extreme to being extremely constricted to where he can't do anything. And then he enters the path. He says, I can give my permission to do this. Well, I can give my permission to do all this stuff. I'm going to eat, drink, and be merry and really have a good time. And so he goes overboard, becomes big partier, gives himself permission to let him go into sex orgies and all kinds of weird stuff, and give themselves permission to do just whatever they feel like, and they go the other extreme, and they give up all that discipline that they've learned. discipline just goes out the window. So here the voice of the Spirit comes to him. So he's like the prodigal son. He goes and parties and squanders all that good press that he earned with the inner voice. But sooner or later, in a moment of silence, he listens again. And the voice says, return to your first love. You've got to go back to the discipline. Sure, you've got permission to do this and that, but it has to be balanced. And the discipline you learned before you entered the path, some of that, not everything you learned before you entered the path is bad. You know, you learned that these guys lied to you and that, but some of that discipline that you got down, you need to take with you and apply it with common sense in your life. Return to your first love. And he said, you mean I just can't do everything I want to do? I got to still control myself? Yep, you still got to control yourself. I mean, you just can't go have an affair with your neighbor's wife or whatever. You can't do anything. You sure give yourself permission. That's an important principle, but not permission to do anything. The guy got permission from his inner self to be somewhat of a rebel, rebel from his group, his teachers that were teaching him false things that he found out weren't really true, didn't really work in his life. Probably hung on for a little while, but then it just got too much to handle, so he broke off. He gave himself permission to be free. But then he goes overboard. Goes overboard and just goes crazy and gives himself permission to do anything that he feels like doing, when he wants to do it and how much he wants to do. And he does this for a period of time until in a quiet moment his soul speaks to him and says, hey, you've left your first love. Everything that you taught wasn't bad. Sure, you've had false teachers, but everything the teachers taught was not bad. They said, do not steal, do not kill, do not hurt people, so on. They taught you some things that were okay. They taught you things that required some discipline. All this worked together for your good. Just don't throw everything away. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, in other words. But keep the things that are good. Return to your first love where you approached learning with a discipline, where you honored your teachers and the things which were good. There were certain things that you've learned as you struggle through your many lifetimes that you want to hold on to. So return to your first love. Recognize the things that are false that you have been taught. Discard them, but not everything was false. Return and honor those, that discipline which you learned over the years. And you know, when I look back to my first love was really the discipline I had in the Mormon church. And it was a strong discipline. We had to pay 10% tithing, a bunch of other donations, amounted to about 15% of our income altogether if you added it all up. It took tremendous discipline to do that. We couldn't drink or smoke or drink coffee. A lot of sexual discipline also, and a lot of discipline that, and also it stimulated within me a desire to learn and to go beyond what I might have otherwise. And so that was probably my first love. And when you break free from something like that, that seems very constrictive at the time, the inclination is to just go crazy the other direction. And this is what the disciple does. And as we study the labor of Hercules Tuesday, you'll see that Hercules, in his labors, made quite a few mistakes also, where he disregarded a lot of things that where he knew better. And so we have to return and center ourselves and create that balance in the middle. Then he gives him some more advice. But this thou hast, thou hatest the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. That's interesting that God, the voice of God says that he hates something. Everybody thinks, well, God doesn't hate anything. God just loves everything. But he says he hates these Nicolaitans. And the Nicolaitans were a group patterned after the disciple Nicholas. And he was really a pretty decent guy. He was quite puritanical. And he was very disciplined. He only had one wife and everything. But somehow, because of certain things that he taught, were kind of word got out that anything goes with St. Nicholas, so to speak. And so his followers, after he was out of the scene, began to distort his teachings and become very promiscuous. But what I think God hated about the Nicolaitans was this, was that they took the teachings of a good man and they distorted them to be exactly the opposite of what he really was, stood for and what he really taught. He was for sexual purity, and they turned it into sexual promiscuity. Larry and I were talking about Joseph Smith. Same thing might have happened to him. There's a lot of speculation that there's a possibility that he might not have had all the physical relations with wives that he was accused of. Yet everybody that followed him said, we're going to practice polygamy and have lots of wives because that's what Joseph Smith wanted us to do. Well, this is what happened with the Nicolaitans. They took a man that believed in sexual purity, only had one wife, and they distorted his teachings to have lots of wives, concubines, lots of sexual relations, everything goes. And so I think what, it doesn't say what God hated about him, but I think what God hated about him was they took a good man's teachings and they turned them completely upside down. Has that happened before in history that we know about? Has it happened with, say, Jesus' teachings on love? For example, I mean, how about the Christian church that burned everybody with fire that asked a question, the wrong question, in the name of Christ? And they said, well, this was an act of love to do this to these guys because it purified the church, so to speak. Was that turning the teachings of Jesus upside down? That's like the doctrines of the Nicolaitans. Disciples will often do this. They even... good disciples that are on the path. Just because a person is on the path doesn't mean he's perfect. But there is one thing that a person learns on the path is to see he saw two things that were really wrong. He saw that he'd been lied to. And the second thing is he saw that the authorities of the day turned a lot of the teachings from the past upside down. And God says, I'm also repulsed by this. I don't like it. And you don't like it. We're on the same page here. So this is one thing the early disciple learns, is to recognize false teachers and also those teachers that take the teachings of the good men from the past, turn them completely upside down. Then it ends with this. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Now, it uses an interesting word here that's a little bit controversial in some circles, to him that overcometh. This is one area where a lot of New Agers are in illusion, is they don't think we have to overcome anything. They think everything should be effortless. And to those who think that, they need to read the title page of the Tibetan's works. And he points out that he has struggled and fought his way to the place on the path where he is, and that we must do the same. In other words, where he is, he had to get there through great struggle and effort. Nothing that is worthwhile comes without struggle or effort. But everybody and every belief system creates a shortcut so the path is easy. How do the born-again Christians do this? What kind of shortcut they got?
Saved by grace.
All you got to do is say, Jesus is Lord. Hallelujah.
No, you go to a priest and let the priest do it for you.
Oh, we're Catholic.
Yeah, in the Catholic Church, the priest will do it for you.
Slave by the Spirit.
Really easy, right? Just Jesus is Lord, that's it. Now, unless you got the wrong view of Jesus. If a Mormon says Jesus is Lord, that's not good enough because you don't believe in the right Jesus. So it's interesting how they have this. Now, every religion has their shortcuts to heaven. Start looking into them. Some of them have a little less shortcuts than others, but they all got these shortcuts.
Thanks for listening to the New Age Christian Synthesis Podcast. If what you heard rang true, you can find out more at J.J. Dewey's website, freeread.com.